So we are at the Center for Molecular and Behavioral Neuroscience at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We're with April Benesich, who's actually a professor of neuroscience. And we're in the Infant Studies Laboratory, or Baby Lab.
Yeah.
Now, we have been watching delightful little bundles come in and have hats put on and go through various tests and stuff. Could you explain what we were seeing? What was going on?
Well, we do a number of things here in the lab to take a look at what baby brains are doing. So we have to figure out a way to get in there and look around and see what's actually happening. And they're not very good at telling us what they're thinking. They don't do meta-analytic discussions. So we have to figure out a way to find out what they're thinking and what their brain is doing. So one of the methods that we use is behavioral, where we train babies to turn their heads when they hear a change in different stimuli. And that's very useful because you can do it automatically, and they can be very young, and you can figure out how different something has to be from another thing, a sound, a visual stimulus, a combination of stimuli, for the baby to take notice of it and to identify it as different. We also use Dense-Array EEG ERP, those very cool, stretchy.
So could you break down the alphabet soup for me as well, just to make sure we're all on the same page?
So we use something called EEG, which is electroencephalography. And some of you have had that if you've been at the doctor's and had put electrodes on your head and listen very, very carefully to what your brain's telling us. And they're very small, very tiny electrical impulses that come from groups of neurons, and you're sensing them on the head. And for babies, we use a dense array, which means we use 64 or 128 electrodes, and we have them in this very stretchy cap. We use a geodesic net system that's very easy to put on. It has sponges with embedded electrodes that we soak in saline solution, and we mark the baby's head at the appropriate anatomical places, and we put it on the child's head. They're all different sizes, so you measure their head first and you see which one fits the best. It's kind of like a shower cap. And then we adjust it. We make sure that the impedances are low so that there's not any static. And the baby forgets about it. It looks kind of intimidating because it has all these wires coming out of it, but it's very lightweight. And once you get the baby or the toddler or the child engaged in something else, they basically forget about it. And so while they're doing something, you can pay attention to what their brain is doing. And that may be the same or different from what you see them doing behaviorally. And it's very, very interesting in infants, but it's also interesting in older children, because if you ask them to respond to something, for instance, the behavioral response can be contaminated by lots of things, including attention and how quickly they respond and what they're paying attention to at the particular moment, whereas we're able to see what their brain is actually doing, whether it's engaged or not.
ERP?
ERP stands for Evoked Response Potential. And another way to say it is cortical time-locked evoked response potentials. And so when you look at an EEG, you can see the brain at each electrode. You can see the electrical activity in different parts of the head. And that's very interesting, but it's really hard for us to know how, because there's lots of things being processed by the brain, it's very hard for us to know how they're responding to the particular sound. For instance, mostly we use auditory ERPs. That's coming in to the child's sensory systems. So what we do is each time a stimulus is presented, there's a mark made on the computer, recording of the brain waves. And so each time you hear a sound, for instance, there's a mark made by the computer. And they get, 1,000 trials of a standard, which is sort of a background sound that is a contrast, and then about 800 trials of something that's different. And so we take all of those trials for the background, sort of the non-target sound, and all of the trials for the target sound, and we lay them one on top of another and line them up by their time markers in the computer. And so what you see when you do that is everything else is canceled out. Like if the child turns for some reason to look at something in another corner of the room, that's one, maybe two trials at the most, and then they turn back. So when you lay all the trials one on top of another, it cancels out any extraneous brain activity that's not related to that, whatever it is you're studying. And so you end up with this very nice brainwave. And you can look at when the signal came on, what the brain did at each of various points on the head, how long it took the brain to respond, and what it did when it got the information. So it's very cool. And there are other, so that gives you a very easy trace to study, and it's something that lots of people, many people in the field use.
These papers that you did, which have had a lot of attention, because you're dealing with extremely young infants, and basically, let me just read a couple of the titles so people know what we're talking about. We just talked about evoked potentials. So, maturation of your auditory evoked potentials from 6 to 48 months, prediction to 3 and 4 year language and cognitive abilities. Another one, early cognitive and language skills are linked to resting frontal gamma power, which we'll get to, across the first 3 years. Functional connectivity of the sensory motor area, naturally sleeping infants, and so on. We'll get to that too. But and another piece I note from a report in Science Daily, impairments in language development can be detected in infants as young as 3 months old. So what we're looking at here is some groundbreaking studies which were basically eavesdropping on the gossip of neurons in very young children and making predictions about how they would behave quite a way down the line. Mm-hmm. So what's the story?
It's very interesting because I look at fairly young infants. We started 2 or 3 months of age. A lot of the studies started 6 months. And it's really interesting to be able to look at the brain as it's developing and as things are changing. Even though it's more difficult to look at infants, it's not as difficult as taking an adult brain, for instance, and pulling apart all of the things that have happened to make, for example, language come into play. So we're looking at something as it's being acquired, and so we're also looking at maturation. So the brain is normally maturing, and when you lay on top of that the skills that the child is acquiring, it allows you to pull apart what's going on as the child acquires it. And we do, as I had noted, prospective longitudinal studies. So we take many children, but we take one child at a time and we follow them across time. So we can look at what's happening. And that's really important because it allows us to see what a difference in maturation, for instance, or in the way or the style that they're processing incoming information, how that affects the way the brain is being put together and allows us to predict which of these things tell us something about where the child's going to end up as an older child whose language is in place and whose cognition is developing.
How long do you hope to track some of these?
We have a group of children who are turning 7, 8, and 9, and that's our oldest group right now. And we've been following them since they were 6 months of age. So we're able to take each child and look at what's happening across time. Some of our studies stop at age 5, but we certainly want to get to a point where we start seeing them when they're nonverbal and they're making some sounds and they're not really doing a lot as far as what you can see on the surface, but there's a lot going on in their brain. And we look at various other things. So we're looking not at, I just talked a little bit about EEG evoked potentials, but we're also looking at, as you noted from one of these papers, we're looking at oscillations. So we're looking at the various frequencies that the brain oscillates at. And this is one way that the brain communicates. So there are different power bands. I mean, there's theta, alpha and theta and beta and gamma. I've been looking mostly at the beta, at the gamma band, just because that's very interesting in that it is sort of the glue that holds percepts together in the brain. It's very important for long-distance connections. And so we're trying to see when the brain is being built, particularly in the language domain, what brain areas are linked together and how do they cooperate to do the task that they need to do. And actually, I look at language as an outcome, but I'm really looking at something that's much more basic. I'm looking at very basic acoustic abilities. How does the brain and in what areas of the brain process very fast successive intervals in time and in sound? So we're looking at temporal integration. We're looking at heavy and sorts of processes where you're building a network of brain cells, of neurons, based on what information is getting in and how it's being organized. And that's has not been done to any great extent in infants.
When you say Hebbian, you're talking about Donald Hebb, the great neuroscientist, and we're talking about neurons that fire together, wire together.
That's exactly right. And a step beyond that, how do those neurons that are wiring together and firing together, how are they sculpted across time as a function of the experience that the child is having?
What's the frequency of gamma?
Well, it's generally in the range anywhere from 30 to about 120 hertz. We look at 30 to 50 just because our equipment gives us the best, cleanest data at that point. But, so that's considered gamma. High gamma is above that, and very high gamma is even further above that. And one of the interesting things about gamma, and a good reason to record it at the scalp, lots of people study it and they use electrophysiological techniques where they actually place multiple electrodes in brains of animals and record. And there are some people that do recording on people who are having surgery for epilepsy and that sort of thing, and they actually record on the brain surface. But the interesting thing about gamma, and Mitch Steinschneider and people like this have looked at that in this in monkey and also in humans, is that because they're higher frequencies, it gives you a much better look at using scalp electrodes at what's going on inside those neuronal networks. It's much less perturbed as it moves through the brain tissue because you have to measure these very tiny electrical impulses that are coming through various areas of the brain. So they have to go through gray and white matter. They have to go through the meninges, the cerebral spinal fluid, and through the skull. And so that can sort of change the character of those waveforms as you pick them up on the scalp. And gamma is the least perturbed of those. And so not only is it important for sort of attaching things together, gluing things together in separate parts of the brain, but it also can be very carefully measured and can give you a lot of insight into what the power level is in a particular individual. In one of our papers, actually, we looked at resting state gamma in children at the age where they're going through their language burst. So we looked at 16 months, 24 months, and 36 months, and we kind of picked a time period when there was a lot going on, there was lots of change. Right. Some children have a couple of words, some of them are talking like adults at that age, and it's really this explosion of language and cognitive functions in general that happens over that time period. So we thought we would look at resting gamma data in those children at that point in time. And we had other data on them because we do longitudinal work, so we had information about when they were babies and information about when they were older. And we were able to see that this resting gamma power, sort of the how much power there was in the oscillation in this 30 to 50 hertz range. So when the brain is just resting and just quietly oscillating, not doing a task, what is the level? What is the power? And it turned out that we found that children who had lower power were much poorer at language skills concurrently and predictively. We have another paper that's hopefully just almost impress. That's the paper I was just talking about before, that shows that we can look concurrently at the same time their power level and their language level, and we can look at how like 16-month or 24-month gamma power predicts to later outcome up to age 5. And it turns out that babies who have higher power have better language and a better cognitive skills, better ability to engage and disengage, attention, which turns out to be very important for learning. And this is something that hadn't been done, that hadn't been looked at in babies, and people, of course, were quite excited about that.
So the emergence of, it says here, the emergence of high-frequency neural synchrony may be critical for cognitive and linguistic development, and that children at risk for language impairments may lag in this process.
That's right.
But you're not doing this, I mean, you're not doing this on people with language deficits specifically. I mean, this generalizes. You're talking about this as a generalized predictive process.
Yeah, it's true. We can look at children who do not have a family history of language problems. We can just look at the general population, and we can see that their level of gamma power tells us something about their later outcomes. But we also, in this particular paper, had a subgroup of kids who were at risk for later language disorders because someone in the family had a language disorder. So we use one of the main populations that we use to look at children who are at higher risk are kids who have a family history, because looking at genetic and family aggregation studies, there's very strong evidence that these children have a much higher risk, anywhere from 30 to 60%, depending on what study you look at, of developing a language disorder if they have one or more people in the family who have a language disorder, like specific language impairment or dyslexia. So that's our at-risk group. We've also looked at very low birth weight preterms who have a threefold increase in learning disorders as compared to children who are normal birth weight. So we're looking at babies that look just like the babies you saw earlier today, adorable, snuggly, attentive, just lovely little babies. And looking at them, there's no way that you could tell whether the child is going to have a problem or not. But using the techniques that we use in this lab, the behavioral techniques and also EEG-ERP, we're able to identify those kids who are much poorer processors of this fast successive information that's really important for language.
On the other side, though, were you able to also to look, find something and say, wow, they're really doing this well?
Absolutely right. We don't talk about that quite as much, but the interesting thing and part of the intervention that we've been working on is the fact that children who do things in an optimal way, that is, they find exactly the right strategy, they process very efficiently, they find what they need to know in the environment, they focus on it, and they get the information just like that. Those children are at a huge disadvantage. A huge advantage. They're at a huge advantage because they are better as young infants, and there's an exponential effect in this ability to, because the more information you have, the deeper your knowledge base, the more able you are to handle and to connect information that's coming in. So we can identify, there's a behavioral paper that you have that looks at thresholds for fast, successive, non-linguistic sounds. And children that are better at this, where we were able to look at 6 months and predict out to age 3, and we've actually predicted out to age 5 already in that paper that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And we can identify those children who are going to be one standard deviation below the mean with about 90% accuracy. And we can identify on the other end of the scale kids who are going to be a standard deviation or more above the mean. So we've been focusing very strongly on how can we help those kids who are not processing as well and who really need this to assemble their knowledge base both in the language and cognitive domains. But the other part of this is that even a child who does not have a family history of a disorder can, first of all, could develop a learning problem. About 8 to 10% of the control group in our studies, normal, healthy, developing children, turn out to have processing problems and then go on to have language disorders. Or if they do not have a lot of difficulty processing information, if they're sort of in the middle ground, they tend not to do as well as those children who are much better at that. So part of what we've been doing, besides figuring out which babies need some help early on, we've been interested also in looking at how can you help parents to optimize their child's brain development at this very important time period that's at really sort of in the beginning of the first year, but continues on through over 3 to 4 years.
How can you?
Well, we actually have been working on an intervention that will sharpen those network areas that are important for laying down language maps. And the way that we've been doing that is we developed an eye tracker setting where we have an infrared eye tracker that tracks the child's eye movements. The child needs to sit there on the parent's lap. We don't have to put any equipment on them, but we capture the eye movement using an infrared sensor that picks up the pupil. And we do something very similar to what we do in the behavioral domain. We give the child something interesting to look at, a visual object that's moving and that's making a sound. And then we change that sound in a particular way, and when it changes, if the child makes an eye movement up to the upper left corner of this large screen that we're using, they get rewarded. They get to see a little snippet of video. They get to see something very interesting going on. And even three-month-olds learn very quickly to do this. They're not old enough to do these head turn procedures that we've been using because their motor skills aren't good enough. But they certainly can do a saccade, so move their eyes from one part to another. So we can get their threshold. We can give them experience with a category of sounds and then train them basically to get better and better at it by making it more difficult as they go through the different sessions. So we've been having babies come in for a pretest for 6 weeks of an hour each of experience with various non-linguistic sounds, including sweeps, so that you hit lots of areas of the acoustic cortex, white noise with gaps in it for them to sharpen their perception of how things might change. So it actually helps them to attend to the important attributes of that stimulus. And if they do that and they detect the difference right away, they get rewarded. And so we're about 3/4 of the way through that experiment, and we don't have language outcomes yet, but we do have outcomes using EEG, ERP, and brainwaves. And what we see is that children who have been exposed to these sounds not very long, for not a very long time period, actually are much better processors of sounds in general. Their brain is faster, responds in a more, with a higher amplitude, and their waveforms for their EEGs look much more mature. They look more like children who are 6 months older. What we'd like to see is what the effect is later on their language, and we're collecting those data now.
But forgive me if I'm being just absolutely dense here, but does that translate into engage your child?
No, you know,
is it more than that?
So there actually is more than that. It's really, really important to engage your child, but you cannot produce these types of sounds except in the language domain. You could, but you can't speed up, for example, the consonant and vowels that you use, because there's a little short 40 millisecond interval that you can hear the difference between a ba and a ga, which is one of the CVs that we use. You can't make that harder for the child. In fact, most parents make it easier by accentuating it. We're looking at non-linguistic sounds, and we're looking at the way the acoustic map is being set up for the sounds that are in the environment. and it's very difficult to give the concentrated sort of input that you get when you have the child in a situation where they're attending, when they're looking at something that's interesting, and where we can give them many trials of a particular sound.
Yeah, I'm just thinking there's somebody sitting at home watching and listening to this and saying, I want one of those. How can I get a hold of that?
Well, we're making a toy.
Oh, okay.
But I think that it is indeed true, and lots of the research, not in my lab, but in other labs, have shown that the parents who are engaged and expose their child to lots of stimulation and outside
inputs.
Thank you. Really do have children who tend to do better. If they talk to them more, I mean, there's all this. It really does make a difference. So we're hoping that if we generate something that could be used, and it would be two things. There would be something that you would use in a clinical environment where you actually could gather data and you could sort of dial something that was appropriate for the child and make it harder as time went on. And we also are trying to work on something that's sort of a toy that the baby could interact with alone or with a parent that actually focuses on these important precursors of language, but is fun for the baby, and that someone could use in an environment that would help more optimal brain development. And we're hoping to make something that's reasonable enough in cost that it wouldn't just be, you know, the enlightened parent who thinks, I want my baby to have everything, or the parents who are able to afford this. We want to make something that could be in the daycare center, that could be something that would be in a clinic, and or something that a physician could check out to a parent. Oh, your three-year-old is having a lot of problems developing their language. Your six-month-old is higher risk. Take this toy home, sign it out, play with your child, you know, every day a little bit with this, or play with them, and then bring it back, and we'll see how they're doing. So that would be nice, wouldn't it?
So two things. First of all, how controversial is this basic research? And secondly, when you're talking about these things, we were at the Ultimate Block Party this weekend, and I talked to Kathy Hirsch-Bosek and several of the other researchers there, and one of the things that we were very concerned about was the prevalence of brain games that were out there that were not really based on very good science and so on and so forth. So you see where I'm going with
this. Absolutely.
So could you speak to that?
There's a difference between brain games like the unmentionable.
Right.
Brain games that really are expected to just engage your child and keep them
otherwise distracted.
Yeah, they keep them distracted. None of that that's out there for babies have any scientific evidence that it does really anything. And I think that one thing that's really important is not to fill your child's life, particularly a very young infant, with things that you do with them. So if you're going to be doing flashcards, so you're trying to push them ahead developmentally so that they're doing something they would have not have done until they were 16 months, you want to have them do it at 12 months. There's no evidence that doing something like that with a baby actually in the long run benefits them. The work that we're doing really focuses on building sort of strong precursors. And we've already shown in 14 years of research that one can identify children who are not building optimal networks by looking at psychophysical data and looking at EEG ERPs. And also we have functional structural MRIs that we can look at changes in brain cortex. We know that the children that are able to do things in a particular way, handle information in a particularly optimal way, that there's a huge advantage for them up the road. And it could be, it's at 3, at 4, at 5, at 6. We haven't gone higher than that. But we're also already seeing effects from children who are more optimal processors, who are better at handling this kind of information at 6 months. We can predict out in the most recent paper that we have published to age 7 to things like pre-reading. So kids who are good at gathering information and focusing on what's important in the environment, which are sort of skills that you learn across time, are actually better at this sort of thing, and it makes their life easier. I actually think, and I don't know whether this is going to prove to be true, that we could expose babies to an environment that's not a huge part of their life. I mean, like, you're not going to be putting them in an intervention that's every day for 6 hours or whatever, which is what you need to do for older children to be able to change the set, the processing set that they're using, to break it down and then to build it up. But when babies are very small, you can gently, very gently guide the brain onto a more optimal way of paying attention to what's in the environment. And if what I think is true from the research that I've done so far and what I believe will happen with the intervention that we're using, I think it could either prevent a child from having a learning disorder at all or might make it ameliorate it, make it less obvious. And when you think about the cost to the family and to the community of a child who's failing in school, for instance, it's just enormous. When I was a postdoc with Paula Talal, one of the first studies that I did was look at children that she, a group of children that she had collected in a study that she did at UCSD many years ago, looking at children from the age of 4 to 6. And they were children who had been diagnosed with specific language impairment. And I basically looked at what happened to them emotionally over that time period. And when you looked early on, this is an old paper now, the children were had sort of things that were typical of kids with learning disorders. They were clumsy, they had difficulty interacting with peers, you know, all of those sort of signs of a child who's having difficulties. By the time the children got to be 6, they could be clinically defined by a scale like the Achenbach of actually being in a clinically troubled category. So the little boys got very aggressive. They were having all sorts of acting out problems, and the little girls in general got very withdrawn and had a lot of difficulty interacting with people in the environment. And those sorts of effects make a mark on a child that lasts forever. I think that if you can find something that is non-invasive, that won't hurt the child, but is just positive, and there's scientific evidence that increasing this particular type of skill predicts to later higher functioning in cognitive and language areas, I think it's very worth letting parents know about this. And that's the difference between something like Baby Einstein that just keeps your child engaged for, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 minutes while you're fixing dinner. There's nothing wrong with a child watching a little bit of that. It's only when you begin to supplant the sorts of exploring behaviors that the child needs to do at that age, because they're explorers, they're learners. They will interact with their environment and get what they need, but sometimes they need help. They need a more enriched type of environment.
I mean, this is rather an obvious thing to say, but let's say it anyway, that all brains are not born equal and they're not given equal opportunities in
That's
the first
exactly
few months
true.
Of life. What a revolution it would be then, you're saying, if some fairly simple technology were available in the course of people's just follow-up after birth, the neonatal environment, where somebody could say, there's a couple of little exercises here, we could get everybody back on path here. I mean, that would be extraordinary.
It would be. It's very exciting. And it's something that has really kept me working. I mean, you were laughing at me with all these papers coming out, and I'm ordering everybody around, do this, do that, get this done.
I would never laugh at you.
But in fact, I really feel as though this is something that could have a huge impact. And I think it is going to be something that's not going to be, I think it's going to be a few exercises. Just because of the time point where we're looking at providing more support to the child. And you're right. I believe that, and this is not proven, but I believe that it would be independent of socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. It would be independent of bilingual input. Because it's really looking at the kinds of skills that you use all through your life. If you think about, for example, some of the behavioral testing that we do, where we show a baby, for example, a face over and over again, and then show once the baby's declined in looking, we show them that same face and compare it with a face that's different. So they have to remember what they've seen. They need to compare the new face with the old face and see if they're the same or different. Yeah. And what babies tend to do is they show you a novelty preference. They look at the new one. So that really illustrates a lot of the sorts of things that you need your entire life. You need to acquire, you need to focus on what's important. You need to acquire the information. You need to stop looking when you've got enough information, so disengage your attention. And then when you meet that particular stimulus again, you need to be able to recognize that you've seen it before, so you have to have the memory. You need to be able to also look at something that's looks the same or looks very similar and note the very fine differences between them. So it's very much like if I give you a multiple choice question, like on the SATs, and I have you read a paragraph, and then I have you answer questions.
Yeah.
I can do the same thing in a very nonverbal kind of way. I track the child's learning trajectory. Do they learn it and then immediately decrement in looking? So they have an exponential sort of acquisition of the data. I look at it, okay, I've got it, I turn away. Or do they look and then look away and then look and then look away? And so I can actually look at that sort of thing. And I can look at how different the novel stimulus has to be from the one that they've already seen, the now familiar one, for them to show a novelty preference. So if I say to you, well, okay, so answer these questions. You've read this paragraph. Now answer these questions. And you have to go back and you have to say, let me see, I remember that. And then you have to go back and read a little piece again and you have to go back and forth like that. That's very similar to children who are really poor processors. And if you could bootstrap that system so that they read something and then they can say, okay, this, they read it, they remember it, they retain what's in it, and then they can answer the questions. It's the same thing in a perceptual kind of way.
Right. Let me put this onto a larger scale, onto a larger stage then. As you know, with colleagues Paula Talal and Terry Sarnofsky, we've been discussing with the XPRIZE Foundation whether you could come up with an XPRIZE in education, one of these incentive-based prizes that's usually, you know, land a rocket or get a car that goes at, you know, masses of miles on almost no fuel. But how you land an education system is a very different and hugely systemic problem. So the question is, can you come up with some sort of measure, some sort of neurometrics that would at least be equivalent to, stand proxy for, the SATs that you mentioned, and could demonstrate a child's neurocapabilities, neurocompetencies? And so you'd look at things like, memory, attention processing, speed of processing, you've
exactly
mentioned some of this, sequencing and prediction, spatial cognition, social cognition, executive function. And if you could devise tests that, and they already exist, there is a literature on many of these things.
But not in babies.
Right. So perhaps you could come up with, first of all, it would be great to get your comment on this, and then see if you could imagine a situation where some sort of neurometrics would be available, easily tested, and which would be sort of giving you some sort of a clue about the competence, neurocompetences. And then if you could come up with technologies that could optimize the performance of this 3 pounds of wonder tissue, it's the only thing that we have in common anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How cool would that be?
Well, it would be very cool. And the issue, I think, in the educational system is that so much of it is curriculum bound and tied to people's theories about how things happen. And the sorts of things that you mentioned are much more basic abilities, and that's really what we need. I think what we really need is to be able to get a profile of the child's strengths and weaknesses in particular areas, but not in English, not in math, not a profile of how one manages information in the world. And that's sort of what I've been talking about. And I really think it is so important to get this as early as possible, because we also don't want children sort of labeled like, well, all right, so your profile looks like this. You need to be in the yellow class, you know, have these things in the school environment. You're in the red class and you're in the yellow class, and everybody knows the yellow class is the dumb kids. I mean, children internalize this so easily. It's really just an awful system. And so one would just be able to assess a child, I hope in infancy, using these information processing sort of tasks. And you would be able to look at things like executive function, like attention, like speed of processing. We can already do that. And we can do it in a nonverbal kind of way. And one would hope that what that would do is there would be a series of exercises prescribed for a child that needed it at a very early age. And if the parents were capable of being involved and engaged in doing that, that would happen. And if not, it would happen in a, you know, a daycare setting or in a, you know, there are lots of ways that I could think of this actually working. And I think that it would, if a child is going to be having a learning disorder, if you could remediate it or ameliorate it before the child even gets into preschool, hopefully before they're even talking, just think alone what that would mean in terms of the child's emotional well-being, the cost to society, sort of like a vaccine against learning disorders. I mean, would that be extremely cool? Yes. Could we do it? I don't know. I kind of think so. And maybe, you know, I just have an idea that there are so many very important ways that we can start to look at these kinds of problems. And people really, scientists in general, have a little bit of difficulty breaking out of a paradigm. There's a particular way that things are done, and maybe we don't need to do it the way things have been done in the past. I, for one, would be very interested. I talked a little bit about a toy that would really not be a toy, but would be sort of an exerciser that a mom could or a dad could use with a baby, and it could be available to all parents. The nice thing about that idea is you're not saying, well, your child has this problem, or your child has this problem. You're saying, we know that this sort of stuff helps babies develop. Faster, better, whatever, more optimally, and it's fun to do. Why don't you try this with your baby? And although you wouldn't be able to say, you know, we changed this child one standard deviation from where they would have been, although there may be ways to develop those studies, I really think it would have a big impact. And we, using the scientific information in more controlled studies, you could actually show that. So I think it's totally possible to do a neurometric that would be based on the sort of information processing that analyses that we're doing with babies. And we have a few papers, one's on resting state. We also looked at structure and looked at the amygdala, which you didn't mention. And we're basically looking at, we took a whole series of MRI scans of naturally sleeping babies, healthy, normal, naturally sleeping babies. And we're now analyzing those data, which are really hard to get because you've got to get the baby into the scanner, you've got to get the parents to come, put the baby to sleep, naturally, you know, give them a bottle, rock them, whatever, then wrap them up, put them in the scanner, scan them for half an hour, and then you have to hand segment all this data. Very hard work. But once you have that, and we're working on templates with Scott Makic's lab, so that when you want to map EEG, ERP activity onto the brain and see where it's coming from, you'll actually have an age-appropriate template. That's another one of the papers that we have.
Scott McKay, of course, another member of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center at UC San Diego. So.
And we're working with colleagues up at Harvard and at MIT to develop these brain models. And it would allow you to say, oh, this is the brain area that's being engaged. And it would allow you to take electrical activity, or magnetoencephalography, and to actually map it onto a head model that's age-appropriate. So if you have a six-month-old, you use a six-month-old head model. Now what do they use? They either use an adult brain. Can you believe that? An adult brain? Or a 10-year-old? And we know how different an adult brain or a 10-year-old's brain is from a six-month-old. So we'd be able to use that to actually take a look at how things are changing across time.
One of the things that I see great hope for all this in, is that in all the conversations we've been having, again, at the Ultimate Block Party, masses of parents and kids there, over 50,000 people in Central Park, according to estimates. But so on the one hand, you have a movie out right now called Waiting for Superman.
Which I have not seen yet, but I heard was amazing, and
right,
really pinpoints the problems in the system.
And then on the other hand, at roughly the same time, there's a piece in The Daily Beast by Diane Ravitch, which says, basically, stop trashing teachers. There's an awful lot of conflict at that level, at the school board level, at the school superintendent level. Do you have a sense that neuroscience might be the oil that could be poured on these troubled waters?
I think so. I think that, you know, people really, the educational system does need some changes. I mean, there are obviously problems. But I think one of the issues in this country is that people have handed over their children to the school system and they think, okay, now it's your job. And in many other countries, that's not the case. And that's something I think we really need to incorporate and to suggest to parents that there are many things that they can do that will help their child to succeed in life. Just being motivated to get the educational background and training is really an important thing. And then neuroscience can actually provide a framework by which we could say, you know, these are the things that your child will need from the time they're a baby until they're an old person. How might one provide the best possible templates for those, for your child?
Well, if the task, overall task, is build better learners.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's a team operation.
It is. And when you have better learners, it will make it easier to change the other side of the equation, to have better curriculum that will fit well with those better learners. I think it's something that's gotten a little bit too politicized. Mm-hmm. And when there's a big institutions involved, there's always this pull for who's got power, who decides about this, who decides about that. I fully anticipate when we start to talk a bit more about the intervention that I've been working on, this sort of toy that would be one arm of what we're developing, that we're going to get a lot of pushback and people are going to be upset. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to make all children the same? Of course, we know that that's not possible because they're all individuals, and the way they incorporate the information is different in every child. But we do know that there are certain pathways that when they're stronger, the children do better in many ways. So we can kind of work on that a little bit.
When you started producing these papers, you must have been expecting a sort of a a very excited response from people, and this was nice new work. But what happened?
Well, it was very surprising because we were so excited about what we were doing, and we couldn't believe how beautiful the data was. And people were not happy, and they were not happy for a number of reasons, because it didn't fit their general theory of how it might work.
How baby brains work,
how one of the things I was looking at, which is very, very loaded, was I was looking at language development, but I wasn't looking at language. I was looking at pre-linguistic babies, kids who are not talking yet, and I was looking at basic acoustic properties of sound. That some of the sounds that we used, some of the stimuli we used were speech-like, but they were not speech. And the prevailing theory has been speech is special. It's a black box. It comes in, it gets processed, it goes out. Nobody really knows how it happens. And it does not happen in the same way that you process these basic acoustic sounds, sound streams. And actually, that's not true. Speech is special. And the way that it's produced has some very special twists to it. But the mechanisms that are used are very much the same, and they're built on very old centers in the brain. So that's why you can study language development and sounds, looking at categorization of speech sounds in chinchilla, which is a really good model for that, or in rat, because the same brain areas that we use for language are used in those sorts of animal models to process these fast successive sounds that happen in tens of milliseconds. But it just was so difficult for people to pull apart their theories, and a lot of people I won't mention any names right now, but the very first paper that I produced showing that we could predict using perceptual thresholds from 6 months to age 3 years. I guess the first paper was we showed that children with a family history of language impairment differed in their perceptual thresholds from children who were normal controls, although these children, of course, are normal. And that one of the difficulties is we're not looking at kids who already have a disorder, so it's not looking at a clinical sample. We're looking at kids who are at higher risk. So you concentrate the number of kids you see in that group that may have a problem, makes it easier to look at contrast between groups. But when I first presented this data, actually at a conference in Stockholm, there were some very high-level people who'd been in the field for years who had always said, if you could show me that these things are impaired, these sorts of abilities are impaired in babies, and if you follow that through and look at what then happens to language, that's something we could believe. But then, of course, I did that. And I thought, oh, they're going to love this. But, of course, they hated it because they said they didn't believe the data. They actually attacked, not just verbally, but ad hominem, and in one case, physically, someone who shook me at it, because people were so unhappy about the fact that I was basically disproving something that they had always believed. And that's always the case when there's a paradigm shift. And even now, it's like 10 years later, we will send things out to be reviewed. We just had a paper that's now in press in neurolinguistics. We got the most hateful review back looking at gamma oscillations in children that were diagnosed with specific language impairment as compared to controls. And we basically showed with a basic acoustic doublet, two signals that, and occasionally one that changed, that children with specific language impairment showed a big decrease in gamma, which shows, aha, I'm paying attention, my brain is processing this. So you'd get a strong gamma response for both controls and family history and controls and children with SLI for the first signal. And then the second signal was just as strong for the second tone that came along, but in kids with SLI, it was very, very weak. Low
SLI
amplitude,
being
specific language impairment. These kids that were diagnosed with language impairment. And we sent the paper out. It's very strong, very clean result. Very, very clear, beautiful data. It's what's been shown in the rat literature. When you do a lesion, when you're looking at up and down states, when the brain is not engaged in attending, you see this sort of effect where the second stimulus that comes in is not picked up. And we got the most hateful review, basically saying that we had preordained what was going to happen. We were withholding data, and all the data was not included. And why wasn't the main effect there? And Sabina Heim, who is the first author on this paper, is a colleague of mine at the University of Konstanz. So she's German, and they said, well, you know, the Germans don't really know how to use language. This is really not appropriate in the way that it's been. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And the reason we get reviews like this are because the people that are doing the reviews are part of this language cohort who really don't want to think about basic acoustic properties being a surrogate for what's going to happen with language. And actually, it's so important because that's what we build our language on top of. And if you don't have a strong system there, then you're going to have a problem when you start to learn language. We have been successful in getting lots of high-level papers in some really, really good journals, but we have not yet had a Science or a Nature paper because when we've sent stuff to these venues, the thought of the editor always is we have to get an opposing view. And once you get an opposing view, people who don't believe the work, even though there are now many converging studies that suggest that this is indeed the case, they just lash out. And then, like with Nature, when you try to rebut that sort of comment, like you can't measure gamma on the scalp, which of course is not true, they say, well, you know, we have so many papers, and if there's any dissent at all, we don't publish it. And so it's kind of like, there's a group of people who can actually keep this information from getting into a broader science setting. It doesn't mean that it's not getting out, because all of the really, the paper that you mentioned, development, maturation of EEG, ERP for babies from 6 months to 4 years, first time it's ever been done, following children 6, 9, 12, 16, 24, 36, 48. Family history kids, controls, looking at maturation and looking at discrepancies. So you're trying to, two streams, you're comparing them, each of them at each age, looking at what waveforms are emerging, and you're looking at maturation overlaid with differences based on poor processing. And it's the first time it's ever been done. It's very, very 5 years of work in this paper. It's finally been published with an editorial because it's very important. It's a landmark paper. But it took us clinical neurophysiology, which has published it, mm-hmm. is the best journal in electrophysiology. And yet we went through 6 reviews in order to get this published because there's a lot of pushback. So that's the trade-off. It's really exciting to do really, really new stuff, but when something's brand new, people say, well, I don't believe it, or who else has shown this? And I think it's a flaw in the scientific community's way of dealing with using peer review to deal with papers, because of course, one of the things that you want to do in science is to find out new things. I mean, isn't that what it's all about? You don't want to keep saying, oh, he was right, and he's right again, and he's right again. You want to say, he may be right, but there's this that's going on. That's so exciting, and it's making us think about things in a very different kind of way. And that's what science is about. I mean, why do science if you don't have it? I mean, if someone came to me tomorrow and showed me data that said, you know, what you're doing is really interesting, but I have data that shows that it's really something very different than you think is motivating these effects. I would be so excited to look at it. And when the day when I can't look at something that's going to make my theory wobble and make me move to another theory, I will leave science. Because you're not a scientist anymore. You're just someone who's trying to consolidate your reputation and keep the system stable. And science shouldn't be stable. It should be wobbling a little bit and moving. And if you don't do that, I really believe you're not a good scientist. And you see people in their 80s who are in this field that are still that way, that are still curious, so still interested and so willing to look at things. And you need that in the field.
Actually, these descriptions of science would be very interesting to young scientists as well. I mean, there's the classic description by Otto von Neurath of science being rather like a boat going along and you're trying to rebuild the boat without actually taking it into dry dock. So there's all these changes going on and so on. Lewis Thomas talked about science as a moving target.
I love this one.
But when you're actually in the midst of it and you're running up against and butting heads with, you know, a peer review system, it's not all fun.
It isn't. But I think you need to steel yourself. This is what I was just telling one of my postdocs out in the main lab. You just get it right back. Just respond, push really hard, and not be discouraged, because it's very hard sometimes.
While we're on this point, I do ask people when we're doing these conversations, what's your advice to a young scientist, actually, having been through that? It sounds like you've got some pretty definitive thoughts about this.
Well, I would just like to say that I have a job, if you can call it a job, because it consumes my entire life, that I love. I get up in the morning, I can't wait to see what we're doing. I get up at 5:30 or 6 and send emails to my colleagues, international colleagues, to find out how those collaborations are going. We are always in this lab on such a steep learning curve that every once in a while you're saying, oh my God, what am I doing? I should never have said I was going to do this. This is so hard and this is so scary, but it's also so exhilarating. It's like taking a drug. And I don't think there could be any more exciting thing to do. And I really believe, I have a lot of young people in my lab. I frequently have high school students during the summer, and they're like agog at everything. And I throw them in. I treat them like graduate students. And they rise to the top because they're excited about what's going on and because I'm expecting them to perform in a particular way. And so I think, you know, science is still such an exciting time. There was a paper a couple of years ago, and you'll probably remember who it was, and I don't, that science is over, that we've already discovered everything that we're ever going to be able to discover.
This was John Horgan's book, The End of
That's
Science,
right.
I think, yes.
That's right. I couldn't remember his name. What baloney. I mean, there's so much that we don't know. Every time I give a talk, particularly to parents, because colleagues are more focused on the details, I do a lot of public lectures, and every time they ask me off the bat probably 5 questions I can't answer, I have to say, wow, that's a really good question, because you know what? We don't know that. We know this, but we don't know that. And yeah, it's a great question, and hopefully we'll find that out someday. So yeah, I think it's a great field. And on the days when I'm discouraged and I'm like, oh my God, I'm never, ever, ever going to get to the top of this list. Yet I'm thankful that I can do this because it's very fun. And also the whole enterprise of interacting with some of the smartest people in the world and having these fabulous intellectual conversations. I mean, there are a few fields where you can do that, but not so many. And that's one thing that's really been fun about the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, because having so many bright people working on so many problems that are just held together by a theory about temporal integration, but each of the research areas are so different, it's very, very exciting. And it makes you think in quite a different way.
Talk about the interactions there with your colleagues. I mean, I spoke earlier, the end of last week, I noticed we have a book here called Rhythms of the Brain. This is by Yuri Buzhaky, of course. we're talking about synchronies, oscillations, and so on. How does that tie in with what you're doing? I assume you collaborate with Yuri, right?
Oh, yeah. Fabulous book. yes. You know, Yuri is a colleague of mine. He's just upstairs. And when I first came here, some of the most difficult conversations I had were with Yuri, because he was, like, so excited about interneurons, which are fabulous and really tell us a lot. But my take on this was, in order to really pull apart what's going on, and Yuri does beautiful work. He's studying things on a systems neuroscience level. He's looking at recording from multiple electrodes. He developed a system where he's able to look at large groups of neurons in more than one place and to look at who's talking to whom, which is very interesting and which is something I'm very interested in.
Right.
But my take on that was that you really need to look at the beginning when this is just being set up, because that's when you're going to be able to catch the network. You're going to catch them red-handed doing exactly what you want to know. When you have an adult brain with everything going on, it's really hard to know what the directionality is and how things are changing across time. But in a developing brain, you can, things are a little bit simpler. They're not simple, but they're a little bit simpler.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort out how things are being, what the pathway is for oscillatory processes. And you can also see differences because the neurotransmitters change a lot across early development. Some begin being excitatory and then switch to being inhibitory. And if you kind of look at that time point, it gives you some clues about why they change that way and why it's important for them to talk to one another. And of course, one of the pieces of research that Yuri did, which is really interesting, was looking at what happens during sleep. So during the sleep cycles, you see theta and gamma oscillations occurring that are directional from the hippocampus up to cortex. So basically, you're kind of uploading information and downloading information. That's sort of how that network works. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that because I'm sure he talked about that. But we can begin to look at some of those things, particularly if we have an idea of what's going on at a particular time period. We can begin to look for some of those signature patterns in the data that we're gathering from infants progressively across time. And so this huge conversation we had about development, I like to take credit for it, but probably it was not just me, but Yuri ended up doing some studies with Israel Ben-Ari, who actually is a developmental systems neuroscientist, and they did some beautiful work that actually looked at what was happening as the brain was developing and oscillatory patterns were developing. And so he now agrees with me that development is indeed very important, because it allows you to watch something emerging, and that's a very powerful tool.
So do you have any sort of basic fundamental givens, any priors about what actually we bring to the stage when we first emerge on it? What I mean by that is, do you think that there's any built-in stuff? Is the brain modular in some sort of way, or is it mostly built as we go along?
I wouldn't say modular.
And I know it's both.
Yeah, I wouldn't say modular, but in fact, it is indeed a work in process, and that there are actually things that are hardwired or almost hardwired in the brain. There sort of has to be. This is true in animal brains as well as ours, but in the more complex human brain, there's some of that. There's a fellow called Waddington who actually talked a lot about canalized processes.
Conrad Waddington.
Yes.
Yes.
And he has a beautiful illustration of what the landscape looks like. And what you see is all these very steep valleys that gradually widen out, steep sort of fjords that open out to much more wider valleys. And early on in development, it is indeed the case that there are hardwired interactions that happen as neurons are being born and as they're moving to the various places in the brain. And so it's kind of like if you roll a ball down that valley, you would need something really big to perturb it so it would jump out of that path. But as you go along further in development, it's actually more shallow and you can get more diversity. And that's exactly what happens in the brain. There are things that need to happen in order to have a viable organism. And a lot of that stuff is very heavily controlled by genes.
Right.
But then once you reach past that point, there is much more of an effective environment. And I'm not just talking about, and there was just something in the paper the other day about this too, I'm not just talking about the environment as to when the mother talks to the baby or what's going on around there. The uterus is also an environment, and the brain itself is an environment. So all of the interactions that happen for axonal guidance, for instance, where there are chemical gradients, where things are steered away or steered toward various targets, all of those can be perturbed by lots of things that are happening in the environment and is happening in the uterus. So I think the brain is both. It's very interaction. It's interactive. It's hard to pull apart. I mean, people talk all the time about nature and nurture, about genes and environment. They're very, very tightly interlocked. And you can begin to pull them apart a little bit, but you have to understand that they're interactional. So, for example, if something changes in an organism, a baby, for instance, that's genetically modulated or is modulated by, for example, maybe them being preterm and not interacting that much, the child's interaction with the environment changes that environment. Mm-hmm. And the change in that environment then affects the baby. So in a lot of very low birth weight preterms, they're very sensitive to outside stimulation, so they kind of shut down. So if you're sitting there and you're holding the baby and you're stimulating them like parents do, "Hi there, how are you? You are so sweet." You know, when you're giving them all of this stimulus, their brains aren't quite ready to take that up. And what they'll do is they'll gaze avert, or sometimes they'll fall asleep as a way to decrease the amount of stimulation that they're getting because their system is just not ready for it. And that's an effect that really reverberates because the mother feels rejected if she doesn't understand what's going on and she feels like, you know, my baby isn't really attending to me. So you've got a whole system. Tiffany Field did a lot of work in this area where you actually change this whole area where the interaction takes place, and it can have very long-lasting effects through the age of the child. So it's really important to understand that. There are some things that are hardwired. There are some things that are sort of medium that will go a particular way unless you're moving it by a strong environmental input. And there are some things that are easily perturbed. Or I don't want to use perturbed. That's actually a word that means for bad, for evil. They can be changed. And that could be for good as well.
So I noticed in your bio that you actually had did a nursing degree before.
That's right.
All of this stuff, but how did you get into any of this in the first place?
I was always fascinated with science. I was a little geeky kid. I'm in the middle of a large family, and I went to the Convent of the Sacred Heart. I mean, I went to undergraduate to elementary school there. And I got in those days, what they did when kids were, I was already reading when I was three, when the curriculum was inadequate for the child, they skipped them. And so I was skipped three times. And when I got to high school, my senior year of high school, I turned 15 that April, so I was 14. So I was very young. was not very good socially because I was a very quiet child and because I was so much younger than everyone else. So I was a little bit of an isolated child, and I just read voraciously all of the time. And one of the things that fascinated me the most was science. And I would read stuff and I would really totally not understand it, but I would love it. I read about physics, and I read Madeleine L'Engle's The Swiftly Tilting Planet, and then I tried to read, and I was like 7 or 8, and I tried to read physics, and I tried to read Einstein's relativity theory, most of which I didn't understand, but I pushed myself really, really hard to kind of sort out what was going on. And I was very interested in the brain, and so that's kind of how I got interested. I got out of school. Got a bunch of scholarships. I was a Regents Scholarship finalist, and I also got 800s on my SATs. So I had lots of scholarships. I was a merit scholarship winner, and my dad didn't want me to go to college because I was 15, and a very young 15. Very inexperienced socially, and so I ended up, he said, I could do two things. I could go to school to become a teacher, or I could go learn nursing, because those were both safe things for girls to do. Yeah. And I ended up applying to Mount Sinai Hospital School of Nursing and was accepted there, and I loved it. I mean, I learned everything, anatomy, physiology, chemistry, biology. It was like eating popcorn. I graduated first in my class after 3 years, and then I couldn't take the boards because I was too young. I had to get permission to do that. And then I got married at 19. So I had two children, and then I went back to school and got a couple of PhDs.
Interesting trajectory.
And my husband left me when I was in graduate school the first year, so I was a single mom with two little kids trying to...
Doing PhDs at the same time?
Doing two PhDs. One in clinical psychology, because I thought, oh my God, you know, I could starve to death doing research. There's not that many jobs out there. And so I took a clinical PhD, which I now mainly use on my colleagues.
Let me ask you this. I mean, there's such a thread of science throughout your life that's hard to imagine you doing anything else. But let me ask you to do that. Is there something else that you might have been? Are you a frustrated opera singer or something?
No, I'm not an opera singer. In fact, when my kids were growing up, I sang to them until they got old enough to go, shh. But I love music. I love architecture. And I think that might have been a path I would have taken because it combines this very creative sort of visual sense, which I don't have quite so much of in my job, with the math, which I adore. I love theoretical math. And so that would be very interesting. And I also think art history is a fascinating area. I'm very curious about things. And I think that no matter what I did, I would try to be in touch with the creative side of myself as well.
So do you paint?
I do. Although I don't. I painted for years. I've sold paintings. I've done oils. I've done watercolors. I made a watercolor for my husband for our anniversary. But I don't, because it requires a level of immersion in my sensory side that I don't allow myself anymore, because I've got so many balls in the air as far as what I'm doing right here. I have all these different collaborations, and I have all my people I need to take care of, so I'm hoping I'll get back to that when life slows down a little bit, if it ever does. I think the one thing that's missing is some of that very creative, visual sort of part of myself, because I do like to look and to try to translate it. I try to do that a little bit in my writing. I enjoy writing, and I've written poetry, and I haven't. And I always thought it would be fun to go back to that. And I also, I'm obsessive compulsive, a little bit. You have to be in this business, and it's an asset. But it also is something that I sort of employ in my personal life, because I also love to give dinner parties. I love to put everything together. I like to set the table and arrange flowers. And we just had a party 2 weeks ago, and I got everything ready, and I made all these gorgeous bouquets, and And I turned to my husband. I said, I don't care if anyone comes because I've just had such a good time doing this. And I like to cook. And I was always very, very good at it. I would do something just to see if I could do it, you know. Something very, very hard that would take 4 days. So there's lots that I like to do. But I do love science, and I'm glad I'm able to do that.
I ask a lot of people this question about what the response to the president's notion of restoring science to its rightful place. I mean, what do you think is the rightful place of science?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty important. And the reason I think that's the case, and people, you know, people love reading about science. They love hearing about these different studies and that sort of thing. So people are interested in it. But I think the reason science is important is because, you know, I was talking about the part of the brain that actually is the underpinnings of language, the area of the brain that animals use to process these very fast successive sounds that are often part of typical coos and calls. Well, I think science is kind of like that. I think if you like to read the history of science and you read about even novels that have science as a background, you can see how it shapes the world in many different ways. It shapes politics, and it also shapes the way people think about what's around them. And it's particularly true in our day now, where we know so much about social interactions, and I mean, all this whole new area that looks at, what is it called, economic, neuroscience,
neuroeconomics,
and social economics. Yeah. Where you're actually looking at the way people move through the world.
Oh, social affective neuroscience.
Yeah, there's all sorts of, and
this
you know,
Matt Lieberman's journal.
That's right. So if you're going to buy stocks and bonds, how do you do it, and what does your brain do when that's happening? I mean, so it's really much more like a gambling sort of paradigm where you light up and you get all this dopamine and serotonin, and if that's happening, are you really thinking about what's going on? Can you divorce yourself from the whole environment of being in a game and actually think about sort of macroeconomics and more global sorts of issues and how that actually affects what you're betting on? Lots of people can't do that because they're so involved in this sort of game that is very compelling to people in general, going through life, you know, being competitive, being aggressive, win, lose, that sort of thing. So I actually think that science has such an important role in life and in the greater life of the country that I think it does need to be something that is an underpinning to society. And, of course, I have a slightly warped view. I don't really think that everything I do is so much more important than anything else. Although my husband frequently says to me, what you do is so much more important than what I do. He's a money manager. He makes a lot of money for people. I try to make a lot of knowledge that we can use. And I think if you look very carefully about the effects of science. I was actually reading this morning about the Nobel Prize for in vitro fertilization this morning on the front page.
Robert Edwards.
Yeah, and Steptoe, I guess, has died.
This was the first test tube babies.
This is the first in vitro, the first test tube babies. And it was interesting because there was a comment in that article that was incredibly true, that when science first comes up with something that's changes life in a way. There's so much resistance. Everybody, I think in the article they said, well, the Pope and the public and politics and the news media were all immediately against this. So you knew that you'd really made a significant discovery because all of a sudden everybody was throwing rocks at you. So there's first that reaction. And then as it becomes something that actually has a positive impact on society. Everybody kind of wants it, and it's new, and it's a little daring, but people do it. And then it becomes very accepted. Mm-hmm. although it really hasn't become that well accepted. There's still issues with that. And I think that in many ways, we can see how science has changed our world and how people take things for... I mean, people get on airplanes and they fly. I mean, it's so counterintuitive, and yet most people don't even think about it, except for people who have phobias. But there are so many things that are in our lives that were generated by science, or science holding hands with medicine, or holding hands with genetics.
You talked about history of science there. I suppose I gave you a time travel token that you could use to bring anybody to your dinner table and have a conversation.
God.
Who would you like to talk to?
Oh,
doesn't have to be one person. Don't have to be all scientists.
Well, you know, I did get to talk to one of the people who I always wanted to talk to. I told you when I was a young girl, I was a physics groupie, and I went to the Santa Fe Institute 5 or 6 or 7 years ago and gave a talk. Afterwards, I was talking with a group of people who had come to listen. I talked about the baby brain, you know, and... I was talking with a man, an older man with gray hair, and he was saying, oh, I read your papers, and it was really interesting, and he was asking me questions about my work. The head of the institute came over and said, oh, April, have you met Murray Gell-Mann? And I was like, oh, my God. I couldn't believe that such a historic character who has just had such an effect on the field, he and Richard Feynman, who I would love to meet. I would love to meet him.
You have to channel him.
I know. Yeah. Was actually interested in my research and talking to me, and that was really quite an experience. I really enjoyed that. There are so many people I would like to talk with. I mean, I just, I kind of lived in the world of books for so many years when I was growing up that I almost felt like I did get to talk to those people and spend time with them. I'm not going to suggest anybody else right now.
I'm sure Murray will be happy to hear about this.
Oh, Murray's a sweetheart.
Where do you see this, if you can encapsulate this, where do you see this work going in the near future?
Well, I really think that given the fact that we could identify those kids that are most at risk, we could, in all probability, I'm not going to say 100%, I think we can keep children from having problems in the future. I think we can change the way the child interacts with the world, processes information, in a way that will allow them to be more effective learners, make them better learners, and will make their lives better. I truly hope we'll be able to do that. One of the things that that I think is very interesting is that based on, you know, a lot of science is very interconnected. Mike Merzenich and Christoph Schreiner and people like that have actually looked at critical periods in rat and discovered that brain areas, nuclei like the nucleus basalis that regulate plasticity, mature early on in the developmental period. We don't know exactly when that happens in humans, but I think the work that we're doing here suggests that there's a... Although the brain is very plastic all the way through the first number of years, and actually pretty much up to 7 or 8 years of age, there's a special type of plasticity to the environment that seems to occur early in the first year, where the brain is maximally responsive to outside input. And that's before those plasticity nuclei are mature. And I think that if we could get in at that point in time, right now we're looking at 3.5 to 4.5 month olds to start. And as I spoke about earlier, gently guide the brain onto a optimally effective processing path. You might see big differences in the percentage of children who have learning disabilities. And when you think about all of the things that accompany a learning disability, talking late or having trouble learning to read, all the emotional impact of that and all of the cost to the system. And it would just be so wonderful to be able to change that part of development the smallest bit. I mean, it's kind of like making this tiny little butterfly wing early on in development and having this huge response later on. I kind of think about it as being sort of something that will be like a vaccine against learning disabilities. And I don't know whether that will be the case, but certainly I hope that's where it'll lead.
So what are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about?
Mm-hmm.
You mean about the work or about the world? You want to know if I'm optimistic about the world? Not a good time. I really think that one of the things that I'm optimistic about is the fact that even though there's all of this publicity about how people don't read anymore and about how they're not really interested in science, people really are very interested in science. I mean, whenever you have a really good program on TV, lots of people see it. I get comments all the time when I do some media stuff. And if you're at a cocktail party and people hear what you do, they immediately, even if I'm getting, my hair done or I'm getting, I'm having an X-ray or whatever, anyone who hears what I do, well, you know, I've always wondered about this. What does the brain do when I'm doing this? And how does that work? And I have a child, and this child does this, and what does that mean in the greater scheme of things? So people still, you know, in many different places, in many walks of life, are still very curious and very interested in life and in science. And if kids aren't turned on to science and math, it's because of the way it's being presented to them. Because there's something just so exciting about even, you know, physics experiments, or if you can just expose kids at a young enough age to all the excitement there is in curiosity and learning. And it doesn't just have to be science. I mean, art history. I mean, there's so many things that, of course, but then when you think, as we said, we talked earlier about what science's place in the world, I think you can take any particular discipline and you can look at how science has had an effect. I mean, I just said art history, but look at what they can do in art history now. And it's all because they're able to break down things chemically and to use all this really nifty new technology to take a look at what's going on the canvases. So if you look at each area, you can really see how science has such an enduring effect. And of course, for my work, the new technology is like amazing because I can look at developing brain non-invasively. I can look at oscillations. I can look at resting state networks. That is, when the baby is sleeping, what networks are being connected and which ones are not connected. So the new technology has made it possible in many different areas. The new technology in genetics, I mean, PCR, I mean, just very exciting. So I'm optimistic about it. I'm an optimistic person.
April, it was great fun talking to you.
It was fun talking with
Thanks
you.
Thanks very much.